We got a real simple plan. One me and one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
If you're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven. This might be college football heaven.
This is ESPN's College Game Day Podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel, here's Reese Davis.
The transfer portal is closed, at least to get in. Wonder how many people got trapped in there. The coaching carousel, at least on the assistant level, will continue to spin. And what about the draft? This is the College Game Day Podcast for Thursday, January 19th. Reese Davis, Pete Thamel, back together again. We're going to talk a little basketball from time to time, but this will still primarily be a college football and upcoming draft-driven edition of the podcast, and that will be the way it is going forward for the next several weeks when we join you. So, Pete, good morning. Good to see you again. We've talked, but not on podcast in between. I want to thank you publicly and in front of everybody for the Whitey Bulger book that you sent me. I'm working my way through it, not as quickly as I'd like as things have come up, but thank you for that. Pete's a thoughtful guy. I mentioned in a podcast that I was fascinated by Whitey Bulger, something that I'd never spoken to Mike Leach about, which was surprising to me, as Mike was. And all of a sudden, one day, this book appears, and it's fascinating. I appreciate you sending that. That's been fun.
We'll give some props to the Boston Globe authors. I believe Shelley Murphy and Kevin Cullen wrote the book that I sent you. I read it a couple years ago, and living in South Boston, especially during the time of Whitey's capture and then his trial was about a mile down the street, it certainly captured the imagination. So for any gangster fans out there, it really does reveal what a hideous guy he was. We make light of him as, but boy, was he a bad guy.
And, right.
They let you know in resplendent detail.
Whew. Yeah, it's we have a mutual. I don't mind because it was a joke, and it was after it was over. I'll never forget Sean McDonough. We were at a big dinner one night, and Sean McDonough's father had grown up with Whitey, and that's detailed in the book to some degree. But we were at a dinner one night, and I think maybe the movie had just come out, Black Mass, and I'd been reading. I really didn't know a lot about him prior to this, and I found out that there was a connection in the past, not to cast aspersions at Sean's father, Will, who was a wonderful sports writer or anything, but there was you have to read the book. There was a lot of intertwining of people who grew up in that area of Boston. And jokingly, I asked Sean, I said, hey, explain to these guys who Whitey or what you think of when you think of Whitey Bulger. John goes, misunderstood. But you know, I just want to clarify, it was a joke. It was vintage, yes. McDonough, yes. Cynicism and sarcasm. Yes.
But, dark, you know, sarcasm.
Yeah, yes. It was funny. But anyway, thank you for that. That's been a nice distraction. And in some ways, there's been a lot of intrigue and comings and goings with the transfer portal. I feel like that while I make the transition into basketball, that in some ways, because of the portal, because of the assistant coaching changes, that your job in some ways ratchets up as soon as the national championship game is over.
I don't know if it ratchets up, but it's a steady stream of a different kind of busy. It's not a build up to a game. It's not a build up to a kind of a moment. It's just sort of this portion of the job didn't exist 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like this just... And look, it's really important. You know, the quarterbacks that are still out there, like Spencer Sanders doesn't have a place to play right now. Like there are like really key people. I mean, he was the conference player of the year. He was the Big 12 offensive player of the year two seasons ago, and he's still sitting out there on the market. And then it's kind of a drumbeat to set up the start of spring, where then at the end of spring, we're going to have another wave of guys who lose quarterback battles and then go. And look, quarterbacks are the engine of a multi-billion-dollar business. It's that simple. In college football, it's the coaches and it's the quarterbacks. And I think it's a little bit of a distant third in a lot of ways. So where the coaches and coordinators go, which we're sort of learning and piecing together here, and then obviously where these quarterbacks end up to sort of be the centerpieces of these programs, we're going to we're settling into the final phase, I would say, of the January version of that, and then there'll be another version of that. So you'd be amused to know with the portal closed that we're taping this the morning after the portal closed, so midnight there, that I was told there will be a flurry of movement with assistant coaches and coordinators, because they basically what they ask the coaches, don't leave until the portal's closed, so our guys can't leave.
Okay, you know what? I want to talk quarterbacks here, but that just sort of leads me to a couple of things. I mean, there's Pete Golding leaving Alabama to go to Ole Miss, and we've seen this play out in various ways over the years. Sometimes, working for Nick is hard, but it's also gratifying in a lot of ways. It depends on your personality. There have also been times when I don't know that I recall, unless you want to count Lane Kiffin. I don't know that I recall Nick Saban ever firing a coach. He always finds a soft landing, graceful exit for people. I don't know for sure. It depends on who you talk to about which way that one went. But either could be possible. That's one thing. TCU getting Kendall Briles after Garrett Riley went to Clemson. All of these are kind of predictable. I'm going to start in an odd place, though. What's happening at Arkansas? I mean, you leave Arkansas to go to TCU. You had this odd exit of players last year, starters in the defensive secondary, leaving Arkansas to go to LSU. You've had a number of guys leave there. Is this pure NIL stuff, or is there, and we all love Sam Pittman. He's great on game day and, you know, turn on that jukebox and I'm going to have one of them old cold beers. He's fun. We like him. But what's happening there, or is it nothing? Is it just the way it is right now with the culture and the way things are in the college football universe?
I think it's a little bit of life at the bottom of a big powerhouse league. There is just going to inherently be the gravitational forces of college football are going to prompt more turnover. I think about Arkansas. And look, it's a good job. It's a proud place. They've won there, but it's a have-not job in the SEC, and it's certainly a have-not job in the SEC West. And because of that, because you have very few local kids who go there, right? Arkansas has some players, but it's not Texas. It's not Florida. So you're going to have a lot of people coming from the outside there. That gives you a little bit more inherent temptation to leave. And I think that Kendall Briles is a serial flirt, so his leaving doesn't stun me. Remember, he was the OC when Major Applewhite got fired at Houston. He was the OC when Willie Taggart got fired at Florida State. He was good at FAU with Lane. And I would say he was good at Arkansas, but I wouldn't say he blew the doors off. He flirted hardcore with Miami, left them at the doorstep last season, did the same to Mississippi State this season. So I think at a certain point, like, that's not a building block for your program. He established himself as a free agent who is going to leave when, not if. So, but I would not be surprised if there are some hurt feelings, because the Mississippi State thing, like, he was all but signed there for 48 hours. And so when you go back and if you're Arkansas and you had to pony up more money and you had to go through the dance, when TCU comes calling, I have a feeling there was a little bit of exhaustion. So that was one where I think they were trying to wait for the portal to close. It broke Wednesday morning that he was going. And look, he's from Stephenville, obviously, and coached in Texas, et cetera. But yeah, it's, you know, with Kendall Briles comes some good production, and then there's obviously some baggage too. It's NCAA issues, his own, not just his father's NCAA issues at Baylor, and with him comes some thorny topics. I saw Brenda Tracy yesterday on Twitter speaking out against the hire. So that's you go in on the Briles, you go in on them. Schematically, there's a tempo there that, you know, is also an adjustment for your program. TCU recent, you can correct me if I'm wrong, didn't go like, you know, they didn't snap the ball every 8 seconds last year. Now, they were spread and they moved a little bit, but they weren't, you know, they didn't evoke the old Baylor. So they can, that's the ratchet to the next level. But it's an interesting move. Do you think that's a good move for TCU?
Possibly. I mean, I think Sonny gives some autonomy, as we learned a lot this year, but he's also, you know, he's also an air raid guy, air raid guy who knows his stuff. So he can keep his hand in it. So I think it was. I think it's probably the beneficiary in all of it, potentially, is Clemson. And it's not because I'm going to sit here and say, wow, after 1 year, Garrett Riley invented offensive football. You know, but he did a really good job with TCU this year. And as we talked about on the show and caught some grief for, Clemson needed a little injection of I don't want to say life because that makes it seem like they weren't trying or they were dead. They needed new ideas. They needed some freshness. And that happens in a program, even one as great as Clemson's is. Sometimes you need someone from the outside to do something a little bit different. And so I think that while Kendall Briles, along with Sonny, that'll work out just fine at TCU, potentially the biggest beneficiary in this will be Clemson. Again, I'm not ordaining Garrett Riley as, you know, the master of all offense. But I do think that having some fresh ideas from the outside and a new perspective and a guy who hasn't been there, as attractive as that is, the continuity that Clemson has had over the years, sometimes you need to do something different. If you find the guy that you think you can fit well into the staff and will do that, it can let you use your talent a little better than perhaps Clemson's been able to the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think it's un-Dabo-like in a lot of ways. It's very early Dabo. See there, Dabo fired him. That was his friend. That was hard for Dabo. He went out and brought in Chad Morris, I believe, was the first outside guy. He had brought in Venables before that. I want to say that was the order about 10 years ago. And those were really the rocks that Clemson was built on. Schematically, recruiting-wise, Dabo, by all our early glimpses, appears to have a world of talent. I will say this for Brandon Streeter. The talent around the quarterback position simply hasn't been what it was there. You can't judge the talent compared to 4 years ago there when they were winning national titles. They had multiple first-round picks at receiver. They were better on the O-line. They were never elite on the O-line. They never had O-lines that had three, you know, first, second-round picks. Like they've been pedestrian on the O-line, and they're good at tailback right now, but it's not first-round picks scare the daylights out of you at tailback. So, like, it's never one thing. It's never, oh, the scheme went stale. These guys all know a lot about football. It's compound interest of your 10% worse at tailback and you're 30% worse at receiver and you're 20% worse than an already kind of middling O-line. And then you have maybe a quarterback with some limitations in a scheme that's not creative enough to tailor it all together.
I hope it works out as well for Brandon Streeter as it has for Billy Napier, because he was able to really jumpstart his career and ended up with head coaching jobs, did a great job at Louisiana, getting things off the ground at Florida. And he has his own issues at quarterback right now. What do you make of this whole Jaden Rashada thing of star high school recruit? Apparently, there was an agreement for a $13 million NIL deal that came apart with the Gator Collective. Now he wants out of it. And this underscores everything that the critics hate about using NIL as enticement. Because you put together this, I mean, on both sides. Number one, if Rashada chose them solely because of the amount of money he was going to make, that's a problem in most cases. If Florida or its collective or its representatives, whoever it is, made offers that they can't back up or won't or decide they don't want to back up, that's a problem. And it kind of, to me, almost is the microcosm of what I've been saying. This is a professional enterprise and we're going to have contracts. That's all there is to it. Because that way you can't say, hey, if you sign with us, we're going to do, you know, our collective. I mean, not that the coaches, whoever made the deal with Rashada, you got a $13 million deal. Oh yeah, you know what? How about seven? I mean, you don't get to do that in life and in business. And that it really, to me, epitomizes just about everything that people on both sides of the arguments critique about using NIL as an inducement to get someone to sign, as opposed to allowing them to capitalize on their value individually as a Gator or a Hurricane or Seminole or whoever.
Well, as the story evolved recently, that's a great point. I feel like this whole story has been a mockery of the NIL will not be a recruiting inducement. Well, yeah, I mean, it was just, like, literally it's like a Saturday Night Live sketch showing what a just parody that idea is. And we all knew when NIL came in that it would be a recruiting inducement. There was no way it wasn't going to be. So a couple things. I made some calls on the Rashada thing yesterday and spoke to some folks. So it's inherent to the fundamental tension that you speak of. The Gator Collective, which issued the deal initially that was signed that they were not able to obviously pay for, doesn't have anything to do traditionally with Florida. Now, there are some ties and they're a sponsor and everything like that, but it's not like Billy Napier shows up at the Gator Collective and says, give Rashada $13 million. So it's sort of an easy truce of trust. And the Rashada one, you can almost see like Rashada going in front of Congress in 2 years when they're trying to figure this stuff out. You know what I mean? It feels like that kind of story. How did this happen? Why did this happen? So the Gator Collective, as it has evolved, I don't think the Gator Collective in Florida will be doing much business anymore. That's what it was sold to me. The quote yesterday from some sources at Florida was the university has serious questions about the relationship, and it makes sense. I don't think, from the conversations I've had, Reese, I don't think Florida would want someone to have a $13 million contract. Like, that's just nonsensical when you look at the market. Like, even the, you know, when you see the Drake May for $5 million rumors, and those were not true, but those are rumors, like, it even blows that out of the water, and the kid's never thrown a pass. So
yeah,
someone freelanced, they couldn't back it up, and now there's the egg, though, goes on the face of Billy Napier and the football program. It goes on the face of the administration. I would think 80% of college football fans don't understand, nor should they, by the way. Like, it's like expecting NBA fans to understand the nuances of salary cap. These are, these are problems of the system. But, like, fans don't understand that it wasn't Billy Napier writing the check. It was, it was someone else from the outside. So you feel for Jaden Rashada, you know, an 18-year-old kid who was going to go 3,000 miles away to go to school, thought he had, look, that's life-changing money, life and position. Yeah, and, like, there you are. There's a contract sitting in front of you for that much money. So I have a lot of empathy for the Rashadas. I never would criticize a kid for taking the best deal, right?
No, I don't think it's wise to make your decision solely. It's not wise long term, regardless of your age. But you're right about that. You're right in a sense that I don't criticize any player for taking. If somebody's trying to give you money for something like that, I mean, you can't say, you know, I mean, if you don't want to go to Florida and you feel like based on your talent, your marketability or whatever, you feel like you can still make $4, 5, 6 million someplace else. You don't really want to go to Florida, but you're going to go because of this. That's a mistake, you know, and even no matter how much money it is, you have to do it. I mean, you have to recognize that and not do it. But, you know, if it's close, or if it's, you know, if it's like, well, you know, I kind of like Florida. Oh, now $13 million, I really like Florida. I don't have any bad feelings toward Jaden Rashada or anyone else for a decision like that.
I think important to note here is that this is going to be a flashpoint. I don't think there's any argument about that. This is going to be a headline that reverberates through the offseason and hopefully prompts some evolution of the rules. So basically, like, you can, you know, places have to fulfill the checks that they sign or the promises that they make. Jaden Rashada is not the only athlete this season to be promised something and have not be delivered. I think all year long, and you probably heard the same thing, there were unhappy players walk for the coach, right? He's got to call the collective and be like, hey, what the heck? Like, my dudes aren't getting theirs. What's happening? Like, that was a far more common scenario this year than percolated up. And I have a feeling this offseason will start to color in the lines on some of those stories of guys who, went out and chose places or chose to stay at places for an agreed upon dollar amount. And then that dollar amount was not delivered to them. And in some ways, I don't blame athletes. If you're going to guarantee someone something, you need to come through with it.
Heck yeah. I mean, no, there's no doubt about that. I mean, you've got to live up to your deals. as I think about this, and I hadn't thought about this prior to the podcast, but just as you were talking about that, I remember when this first started, and I still believe this to a degree. I just don't know if we can tolerate the pain it will take to get there. But I do believe that the market will take care of itself. This might be an example of the market correcting itself a little bit. People got over their skis with the Rashada deal. The other ones that you mentioned, they've happened at some predictable places. And, you know, this might be a little bit of a market correction. We all react and want somebody to fix it right now, and that's probably the best thing for the sport. I'm not sure that's possible until we find out who would collectively bargain with whom and how that would work. But, and that's not a panacea. That doesn't mean it's going to fix every little thing if they suddenly find a way to bargain this out. But it will certainly make it more orderly once that happens. But in this case, this could be a bit of a market correction, because now, even though coaches can't really, as you perfectly pointed out, can't and don't have time to really get involved in all this collective stuff, and you pay him this and you pay him that and act like a general manager in the NFL, the one thing they can do is to make sure that their guys aren't getting hosed, and they don't want to be any part of their guys getting hosed, because that will have a trickle-down effect of wrecking your team. And I don't care who you are, that kind of thing will wreck your career. You know, if you lose a team and have it crumble because of something like that, you can lose your job no matter how much success you've had over a period of time if it's not rectified. So it's a big deal, and how quickly the market corrects is probably an indicator of how coaches are going to have to react to it and how they can save themselves from it. Yeah.
And market's a great word, Reese. Let me put a bow on it with this. Don't underestimate the dynamics of the Miami-Florida rivalry in this. Remember, Rashada was committed to Miami. It was, again, reportedly, supposedly $9 million. And then all of a sudden, he's at Florida for 13. Like, don't think those guys in the booster set who are in the same country clubs and travel in the same beach club circles and are in the same worlds, don't think that rivalry doesn't put pressure points to, oh, well, we need to get him more. We need to get him more. You know, it's the same thing, the old stories of lore of the, you know, the bagmen and how they would gin up money. It's just above board now until it's not.
Yeah. That was the thing. Stephen Godfrey wrote an unbelievable piece about some of the bagmen. He wrote it several years ago. And basically, the central tenet of it was this. If you wanted to be involved in player acquisition, then you didn't know the coach. You didn't go to the country club with the coach. You didn't have your picture made with the coach. You don't know the coach. You're just in the player acquisition business and keeping a proper distance. If you wanted to know the coach, then you donated the money. And I'm paraphrasing broadly. If Stephen listens to this, he probably will say, you got this all wrong. But if you want to know the coach, then you donate the money to put your name on the locker room or the weight room or something. That was the difference. Player acquisition, you kept on the low, and that's changed a little bit with this collective.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We've got Matt Miller, our NFL draft guru, joining us now to talk a little draft. I want to do one thing that sort of weaves in the NFL and college together. I really thought, Pete, and I know you have to have a taker, and Matt, I'd really be interested in your take on this too. I thought Jim Harbaugh was probably gone to the NFL. That appears to not be the case now. Last year, I know, you know, he went to Minnesota and talked to them, and there were reportedly teams interested this year. Matt, will bring you in first, and then Pete, I'd love to know your reaction to it too. I expected Jim Harbaugh to leave, to go to the NFL, and it appears he's not going to. What'd you think, Matt?
Welcome, Matt.
Yeah, Reese, thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it. I was shocked as well. Pete, I really thought this would be the year, right? Like you said, last year the flirtation was serious with the Minnesota Vikings, so it seemed like, okay, this is the year. And you guys cover college football better than anyone. You know this better than anyone. To me, it feels like Michigan has kind of reached the peak of the mountain. Like, how much higher can Jim Harbaugh take Michigan? You know, you've had back-to-back years beating Ohio State. You've made the college football playoffs. Can you win a national championship? Can you overcome a Georgia or an Alabama? Can you consistently keep Ohio State down? To me, it seemed like the time was right for him to parlay that into the NFL job that he has seemed to want so badly. So it's definitely a surprise for me.
You know, it's a good point, Matt. The distance from 3-1 essentially that Michigan has to travel is a pretty good distance. And look, they would have played Georgia more competitively in the national title game, and more competitively than TCU did, certainly, and I think more competitively than last season when they played in the Peach Bowl. But that said, I don't think any of us sitting here with a straight face would have predicted that they were going to win that game either. So, yeah, you know, one of the interesting dynamics, and Matt, you know more of the nuance of the NFL hiring rules than I do. The college football hiring, God bless it, is quintessentially college. It is private planes, dark of night, shotgun marriages, like boost. Like it is a beautiful
mess. All the stuff we love, Matt. You know?
Yes, exactly. That's what we lean into.
Flight
the chaos
trackers
here, and that is the chaos. The NFL is really refined, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but this week, post wild card, I believe, is the first time that people with jobs open can sit down with candidates. Correct? Aren't there the refined rules in that way?
Yeah, there's. It's not quite as shadowy. There are ways around it, of course. Yeah. But you're right. This was the first week where you can do. Previously, you could do like what we're doing right now. You could do a Zoom or a virtual interview. Yep. But this was the first week where you could actually sit down with people. And I think there's a benefit to that. It's why we're probably going to see the open jobs get filled, you know, very quickly. We've seen the two general manager jobs get filled once those restrictions were kind of lifted. So, yeah, it's definitely not as, you know, backdoors college football hirings might be. There's not a Reddit thread, you know, devoted to tracking where everybody's flying around. But I also think like. I know, right? I don't know if Adam Schefter could handle the craziness of hiring season if it was that way.
He'd probably be on the plane knowing Adam. So like
that, actually, you're right. Yeah, I do think Harbaugh has ways around it, just like everyone does. You know, I mean, he's so well connected, but it was a surprise.
But the point, I guess, Matt, was like, this is the first week they could have hired him.
Kind of, yeah.
So that's for if you're a college football coach and your season ends on January 1st. That is an eternity to go to January 17th, just to pick a day. That's an eternity of limbo. And his interview, his Zoom with the Broncos, which I believe was last Monday, so that's now 10 days ago, let's just say. Boy, that's a long time to leave an entire university.
Oh, absolutely.
Flux. And yeah. I bring up the point to say that I think that set of situations made this difficult for Jim Harbaugh. But I also think projecting forward – if you are going to go hire a college coach, that's the set of circumstances, and I appreciate and know why the NFL laid them out, and I'm not criticizing it at all. I'm just saying that, boy, it's harder to hire a college coach now than it was, you know, before all these rules, because it's so fragile. And once it comes out that you're talking to somebody, you put your whole program in flux. And Harbaugh did it last year by going to talk to the Vikings on signing day, if I believe, in quintessential Jim Harbaugh fashion. And so, again, he put his program in flux for 8-10 days again this year before calling Santa Ono backing up a bus over Ward Manuel, his AD, by just straight up going around him and then sort of waving a flag about how he went around him to get. And there's no contract, by the way. Like, he's just said he's coming back. Like, they haven't agreed to a new deal yet or anything. So it's all sort of perfectly bizarre Jim Harbaugh in a lot of ways. And but I think my takeaway from tracking this for the last 2 weeks is that, I'm not saying no college coaches are ever going to be hired or anything dramatic like that, but the way the rules are set now, boy, does it make it hard.
And look at the guys, and I'm not one of those guys who thinks that college coaches can't or won't have success in the NFL, but they haven't right. recently, by and large, with the exception of Harbaugh. And you also have seen a number of guys have success coming from the coordinator ranks in the NFL who are young guys, who probably, in all fairness, wouldn't do well as a college head coach because of the things they have to handle. When I'm watching the NFL and I watch the playoffs, I was thinking the other night, and I don't want to call any names to cast any aspersions because I don't know these guys personally, but I'm sitting there looking, going, yeah, I can't see him as a head coach at Michigan yeah. or at Ohio State or Alabama. He's not ready for that. Yeah. You know, and it's a really odd dynamic of a guy who would be suited to do both. But the other thing that's happening for sure is that because of the calendar in college and the fact that there is no let up because you're recruiting your own players, they're going in the portal. We just finished talking about this NIL collective deal at Florida, and that's not the only place where they've had issues like that. There are guys in our sport who are dying lousy to get to the NFL, to have some, not that they think it's easy, but so that they can have some type of yeah. structure yeah. to their life and their career. Really, they can, you know, they're not going to walk into the office one day without having had the general manager give them any type of heads up. And, oh, by the way, your entire defensive secondary is gone. Wait, what? Yeah. You know, I mean, there are things that is very attractive to college coaches right now about coaching in the NFL.
So, Matt, I'm going to interject for a little inside podcast fodder here. Reese, we need to know about your Jaguar fandom.
Woo, baby.
Reese yeah. moved to Jacksonville recently, and he's sort of become a reluctant adopter, and it's sped up this season of being a Jag fan. Yeah. And so we were texting over the weekend. I, of course, went to bed and missed the whole comeback because I have a 11-month-old, and I just didn't really think they were going to win, and I was tired. So, Reese, how did the great comeback shape your Jag fandom? And can you topple the mighty Chiefs this weekend? Are you using we?
Yes, I'm using we. Okay, let me tell Matt how this works. Matt, I grew up quick, a college football fan, dyed in the wool, liked the NFL. My allegiances have shifted. When I was a little kid, I was a Saints fan because I loved Archie Manning. Then I was an Elway fan, but I never really locked in on a team, okay? So in my house, my wife went to Auburn, went to Alabama. Our kids are divided. So, but they were Falcons fans. So I was sort of, you know, I rooted for the Falcons in the Super Bowl and stuff like that. And
yeah, sorry.
Kind of just followed the guys that I liked in college. That was the guys I enjoyed covering in college. You know, I rooted for them to do well. So when we moved here, my son actually said, "Hey, why don't we just adopt the Jags?" So we did, and it's been a little bit of a force, to be honest, because you're trying to make yourself really be emotional about it. The turning point was the overtime pick six by Rayshon Jenkins. That gave me a little emotion. But then the other night, down, I wasn't angry, like, you know, like maybe a lifelong fan would be, but I was like, oh, geez, good night. Five turnovers in the first half, you know, this is over. But the comeback and then realizing and then really having your brain start calculating, okay, there are enough possessions yeah. here. Get a stop here. Got a chance. You know, and so it helped it. But the thing that might have set it over the top, my wife and I were out running errands yesterday. And as we were driving down the street, there was a pickup truck that came. It was some business or something. And it had a giant mannequin sitting in the bed of the truck up on a throne, right? And it had a Trevor Lawrence jersey on it. So it was like...
Did they have a wig on it? My wife said, did it have the long hair? Okay,
it did.
Good.
Yeah, it did. And my wife said, You know, we didn't see that. People didn't drive through the streets of Connecticut with even with a Tom right. Brady mannequin in the back of their truck. That just didn't happen in New England. So yeah, it helped. But the best text, Matt, I'm sorry to ramble on here, was from Pete the next morning, who was still mockingly thought the Jags had lost.
Oh, yeah. I had no idea. When I say no idea, no idea.
No idea. I got a text that followed up that said, oh, my God, they won. How did that happen?
I sent him a text at halftime because I was like, you know, good luck tonight with your team. And then it didn't go well. And then you know, Reese sent a clip of like a fan outside celebrating. I was like, why is that guy so happy? And then I like flipped on my app and I was like, oh, my God. So, yes, when our season ends, I tend to try to rest. So,
yes, understood.
It's a good transition to the draft, right, Reese? Now that we've got our Duval out. Matt, who are you most excited about? Like who gets you fired up in this draft class when you obviously follow the sport really closely? Matt's a Texas fan, by the way, Reese. Die in the wool.
So we didn't have to bring that up.
apologies right? for the last decade or so. There's been some moments. But just who gets you you know, when you're watching film, who gets your spine up straight and kind of does the like the gif of the clicker like you know, in the video game? Who gets you going?
Well, I can't say Bijan Robinson now because you outed me. So
yeah, he's an
still,
exciting prospect.
He still does.
Yeah, you can say that for him,
right? Bijan's fantastic. He's gonna be fascinating. But to me, it's Will Anderson. You know, I waited 2 years to be able to truly evaluate him. You know, you are aware of freshman and sophomore, and you're like, God, guy's a player, especially Will, the sophomore season he had. And so you find yourself almost sitting on your hands. You're like, okay, wait, I can't watch him yet. You know, I can't evaluate him yet. He's not eligible. Let me focus on the guys who are. But you couldn't overlook number 31. So I was really excited to get to break him down this year. And I know there's the talk about, you know, he took a step back this year. Well, his numbers weren't as good. I still think he was one of the best defensive players in college football. He still has, you know, the traits that we look for. It's so different my job is, because we're not just looking at stats, as you guys know. We're looking at, do you have the traits to produce those stats that will then translate to the NFL? And I think Will has all those, you know, to be a potential number one pick, depending on if the Bears keep that selection or trade it out. But, you know, I'm also, you know, a big Bryce Young guy. And I know there's going to be questions about size because he's 5'11 and probably will be 200 pounds by the combine. But, you know, I was there in Austin to watch them beat Texas, and the poise that he has in the pocket, you know, there was a play where they bring a corner blitz on third down and he shrugs it off and throws a game clinching throw basically to Jamar Gibbs out of the backfield. And it's just, you don't see poise like that in college quarterbacks. So I know going to Alabama players is maybe not that fun, but they're definitely guys that, I mean, they look like they're going to be special pros.
Matt, I'm going to tell you, I've been saying for a couple of years, and I love Bryce Young too. In fact, if Bryce were a little bigger, I would put him in the Andrew Luck thing of like best quarterback I've ever seen. You know, that's the only thing he's not big. But I've said this for 2 years. Anybody that goes into that draft, which I'll be hosting on ABC Thursday night, and they don't call the name Will Anderson first, they're doing the draft wrong. I believe that.
Yeah, I think he's special. Again, like I said, he's my number one player. He has been wire to wire. It's everything you want, especially in the way the league's going. You know, you need someone that could chase down quarterbacks, and he does that at an exceptionally high rate. And, you know, almost like Nick Bosa, even when he doesn't get there, he's close. He's making plays. It's pressures, it's hurries, it's hits. You know, he's going to be there to pick up the forced fumble that changes a game. So it's funny, both Alabama players are going to get hit for size, which you don't expect from a Nick Saban team to be, oh, these guys are a little undersized, but they're both just absolutely amazing. And to your point, if Bryce Young were bigger, I would be comparing him to Joe Burrow, because the poise, the accuracy, just some of that innate ability to play quarterback, it's really special.
Matt, if you wanted to get invited back on the podcast, like starting your draft analysis with Will Anderson was a really good way to warm yourself to Reese.
I've been doing research all night, didn't sleep.
We have our little joking crushes that we talk about on the pod. Reese's is Will Anderson draft crush, and then he has a Drake May crush for next year that's going to carry on in a running joke. He's proud of his crushes. Let me ask you this: the Will Anderson junior season statistical dip is an interesting thing, right? Like he's still an elite player. His numbers in a vacuum are still really good. They just weren't as good as his preposterous numbers. When you did break him down, was there like an inordinate, could you explain that a little bit maybe? Was there an inordinate amount of attention? Were all the, you know, line calls shifted to him? Was he chipped consistently? Like what did you think from watching him every play this year contributed to some of that statistical dip?
Yeah, Pete, I think there are reasons, obviously, you know, offensive line shifting. There are some missed tackles on his part that affected. And I think if you were going to pull up a negative, it would be he needs to come under control a little bit better at you know, the point of impact, because there are missed tackles. But I think we also, like, we fall guilty to this in the NFL a lot of, like, if we were being honest, Tom Brady should probably have like 20 MVPs because he's the best player in football for the last, you know, 20 years until Patrick Mahomes came around. And the same for Mahomes. Like, we developed this level of expectation that is impossible to match. You know, Brady throws for 55 touchdowns or whatever, and it's like, okay, well, if he doesn't do that again, he can't be MVP. I feel like Will got a little bit of that. If you had an historic season as a sophomore, and like that didn't set the level. Like, that was a historic season. And instead of celebrating his junior year, people were like, well, he didn't have 17 and a half sacks this year. Well, yeah, he wasn't going to, you know, that's not, it doesn't work that way. He still was incredibly productive. My concern would have been if he completely dropped off, you know, if we saw 5 sacks this year, or we didn't see the same burst in explosiveness, because then you could start to raise questions about, you know, was this just a magical season, or, you know, is he saving himself for the NFL a little bit? I didn't see any of that. I just saw a guy that offenses paid a lot more attention to this year. And, you know, also there's the fact that he did have some missed tackles in the backfield that really would have boosted it, at least the TFLs, if not the sacks too. Mm-hmm.
So you had put up last week, you and your fellow draft experts did a pretty cool exercise that I appreciated. Mel Kiper, Todd McShay, the great Matt Miller and Jordan Reed all put up your kind of positional rankings. So yeah. I'm glad you're here, because you're basically like a fact checker for all the debates recent I've had this season. So we're gonna make you the arbiter. We're gonna make you the arbiter of the Will Levis argument. All right.
Oh yeah, that's a fun one.
I would cast Reese as a modest skeptic of Will Levis because of production. Reese, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, you're right.
That's been the tenor. He's obviously a good player. Yeah. So when I look and see that you have him third, interestingly, Mel has him first, and you know, Reed has him fourth. So I think, like, right there you have, you know, some pretty interesting division. What is the attraction to, you know, the NFL of Will Levis? What can he become? And I just think he's going to be one of those prospects, like, he could go third or 33rd, right? Like, it's a pretty interesting, modestly divisive guy.
Yeah, I mean, no, he's polarizing. And I think, you know, we'll get into that. It'll be fun to chop it up and give Mel a hard time about him having him first. But I look at Will, and I was all aboard the hype train over the summer. You know, watching last year's tape was like, okay, he's going to cut down on the interceptions. We've got this 6'4", 230-pound guy with a huge arm, and he runs, and he's aggressive. He climbs the pocket well. I mean, I was ready to go. I was strapping up for him, but it's just the turnovers drive me crazy with Will, which is why he's third for me, despite, you know, having the size that Bryce Young doesn't and having the willingness to use his mobility that CJ Stroud doesn't always show. I know he did against Georgia. So I think the two questions you have about the top two guys, well, Will answers those. It's just the problem that, like, you can watch him play, you know, an average SEC team, and he might go 20 of 24 with 2 interceptions. And it's kind of, you know, mind boggling, because there are so many times he looks fantastic. And then there are so many times you're wondering, like, what is he seeing? And it's almost that he's not inaccurate. It's that he makes poor decisions. And so that's where I wonder, like, can you fix that? Can you iron that out? Everyone wants to point to Josh Allen, which I scouted Josh in person 3 times while he was at Wyoming, and it's different. It was a very different player. But I think everybody now sees Josh Allen as the, well, we can fix that, you know. And it's, I think when you try to do that, you end up with Zach Wilson's, and you end up with, you know, even Carson Wentz to some degree, who I think is probably what Will Levis is closest to being, is a guy who has a little bit of a slow trigger and doesn't always see things super quickly and tries to just win games with his arm. It's a lot of hero ball from him. And I think, yes, there are really good traits that someone could look back in 2 years and pull this up and cold take us on this. But I think with the draft, it's almost like investing in a stock, and you look at the risk factors of, okay, where could this player be? But if they don't hit those markers, where are they at? And that's for me why he's third.
I would definitely, and Pete's right, I am a skeptic, mostly for the reasons that you have pointed out. But because this league is quarterback star driven, lower first round, well, I'd take him in a heartbeat if I need the, because he has those traits and there is the capability. Yeah. I agree with you. I had questions. I really like Josh Allen, like him a lot better than Will Levis coming out. But I had questions about Josh simply because he didn't produce against when Wyoming played the upper echelon. Yeah. He did not necessarily play well. I remember one game particularly against Iowa that he didn't play well at all. Now, how much of that is attributable to the fact that, you know, his receivers at Wyoming, while certainly good players, and they wouldn't be Division I football players, might not have matched up against, you know, the upper echelon of football. But it still seemed different watching him. It seemed like when you watched him, it was just, can you fix the accuracy a little bit? I have more questions far more questions about Levis than about Allen. But I want to turn it to something else you said with C.J. Stroud. How much did C.J. Stroud, it's only one game, everything was on the line, and they had to have him do everything to try to win it in terms of being willing to leave the pocket, run the ball. I don't think he's particularly gifted as a runner, particularly athletic. He's not a bad athlete, but he's, you know, to suppose that he's some great runner who won't do it is not accurate, I don't think.
Right.
But how much did just the moxie he showed, the willingness to sacrifice everything to try to get his team a win and ultimately put them in position to win the game, how much did that help him in terms of not only your evaluation, but the way he might be perceived by teams?
Yeah, it helped a lot. I mean, he made himself money, you know, to put it in a very digestible sentence. I think he answered a lot of the questions. Even, you know, like you were saying, Reese, I'm skeptical about Will Levis as well. I think the skeptics about C.J. Stroud were pointing to, man, he really doesn't like to move. You know, it's if it's not there, he's throwing it away or he's taking sacks. I think that willingness, not to say that he's, you know, Lamar Jackson or Josh Allen as a runner, but to show that, hey, I can extend the play. I can create, you know, room with my feet. I can, you know, find those passing windows that are outside the pocket. He almost played a little bit outside the scheme, which is, you know, the biggest question for Ohio State quarterbacks is, will the scheme so good that they don't have to get to the third progression and that they don't have to, you know, do this and that? Well, he had to against Georgia because they're so good. You know, he had to move. He had to get to third progression. And I think he showed more of an NFL style game that day. Obviously, we could talk about how talented his receivers are, and that's going to inflate his numbers. The scheme is fantastic as well. But he still has to make the throws. And I think that's what sometimes people forget is Marvin Harrison Jr. can be the second coming of Randy Moss, but CJ still has to get the ball there, you know, and he's done that very well. I think his accuracy is incredibly underrated. You know, the way that he can layer the ball in to give guys those run after catch ability, like it's all there. And he checks those boxes and has for 2 years, really. So I think some of the CJ Stroud criticism is not warranted. You know, one of my go-to sayings is scout the player, not the helmet. You know, every Ohio State quarterback is not the same. Obviously, Justin Fields ran for 1,000 yards in the NFL, and we're talking about C.J. Stroud not wanting to run. So I think you have to put those guys in a bubble. And this, you know, scheme is important to understand what they're asked to do. But, you know, trying to look at the way C.J. throws the ball down the field and even intermediately is, I mean, it's beautiful accuracy.
Well, this is not a scheme, but coincidentally this morning in my inbox, I saw the Matt Miller way too early look at the top quarterbacks, receivers, and defenders in the 2024 draft. What a coincidence.
Never too early, boys.
Available on ESPN Plus.
If you don't have Drake May at the top, you're not doing it right.
He's way up there. He's way, way up there. Thankfully, I didn't have to put like a number next to the players. Right now, it's just a list. It's just a watch list.
Who are you excited about as prospects when you do peek ahead? Who are some of the most exciting prospects for next season? And there's obviously a few mainstream guys. Give us a couple off the radar guys, too.
I mean, obviously, Drake May. That's what I'm very excited for, just to keep Reese happy.
You really want to get invited back.
I do. I love, you know, it's like everyone has said it. I'm not unique here. It's Justin Herbert. I mean, it's like watching Justin all over again, which is a pretty good thing. He's a pretty good quarterback. Caleb Williams obviously is very mainstream as a returning Heisman winner. I'm excited to see what he can do in, you know, another year of that offense. And as they build, hopefully, a defense that can support him, I think they could be pretty special. But also in the Pac-12, like Michael Penix going back to Washington is pretty exciting. And Bo Nix going back to Oregon. Like, there will be at least three very good quarterbacks in the Pac-12 that have major draft implications. So as good as like this year is, this is a really good draft class in 2023. Everyone always says, oh, next year's better. I don't know that next year will be better, but it's going to be really, really good. Joe Alt at Notre Dame at left tackle looks like a very special player. His dad obviously played in the NFL. Olufoshana going back to Penn State was, I think, the surprise of draft season, was a projected top 10 pick saying, no, I need to get better. I'm going to go back to, you know, Penn State for a year.
He's really young too, isn't he, Matt?
He is.
Like,
yeah.
Maybe 19. And
I think
old,
19.
Like that.
Yeah. I make it, you know, my job to not get involved in those decisions. I'm happy for the player, whatever they decide to do, because, you know, we don't know their situations. That one legitimately surprised me to where, I mean, I had trainers and agents texting me like, what is this guy doing? Like, well, he's doing whatever he wants. He's doing what's best for his situation. But I mean, he'll come into the year as a potential top five pick. Same with Jared Verse, who went back to Florida State. You know, he'll be a projected top 10 pick right out of the gate next year. And it's exciting to see what those guys can do and build on, honestly.
Any give us someone way off the radar who's, you know, maybe not on your list today that just excites you. I have a two-part question here. It's fun having Matt here because you can just sort of spitball all the things you're like. Can he be remade at Oregon State?
He can be. Yeah. You know, I think we saw that this year with Spencer Rattler, who had huge draft hype headed into that last year at Oklahoma when he got benched at the Texas game for Caleb Williams. And everyone thought, oh, can he remake himself at South Carolina? His problems followed him to South Carolina, even though he had a better year. There's still the turnovers. There's still, you know, that style of play is almost being phased out a little bit. So, yes, I think I was a big DJ fan. After that Notre Dame game his freshman year, it was like, this is the guy. You know, this would be the next great Clemson quarterback. And, you know, I think he's just been held back to some degree by an offensive line that just refuses to get better. Clemson's receivers have dropped off since, you know, what we saw with Deshaun Watson and Trevor Lawrence. So, yeah, I do think it's possible, Pete, that he can go somewhere and get a better system around him to accentuate what he does well. For off the radar, man, that's tough. There's so many guys. I think Leonard Taylor at Miami is probably one that I've heard the most about from scouts that say this guy was, you know, a five-star recruit. He's not played a ton, but, you know, kind of that put him in your back pocket because he could blow up if, you know, if everything ends up right. So Miami, I like where things are going down there. I think they're recruiting very well, as you guys know. But I think Leonard Taylor is a name to kind of store away. If we see the U, you know, have a resurgence, it'll probably be the defense that leads it, or at least the trenches. So he's someone I'm watching.
Matt, what do you think about Tyler Van Dyke? He was a guy before the season who shot up on radars and then obviously didn't have a great season. Do you think he can regain his trajectory?
Salvageable, yeah. I think we saw it over the second half of the season. You know, it feels like, I'm a big Mario Cristobal fan. I think he's a fantastic coach. It feels like they brought a scheme that didn't fit Van Dyke, and they realized that about week six, and they started to try to change some things, and there were some positive results. So I think that's something they have to figure out over the summer is, what does this offense look like? You know, how do we change things if Tyler's going to be our guy? How do we better support him? But also just, you know, growing up that team around them, they were incredibly young. So I think salvageable is a good word. I was happy to see him go back to college. I know there was conversations about him entering the draft. Was happy to see that he stayed at Miami, honestly, instead of hitting the portal and trying to find, you know, maybe a better situation for 2023. He, you know, staying where he's at and trying to improve there.
Matt, this has been fun. Have we been sufficiently welcoming that if we ask you back at some point before the draft, you'll be willing to return?
Only if we could talk about Drake May.
This could become a Drake May podcast.
It could quickly.
Well, now don't do this, because see, here's what's going to happen. I have this theory, Matt, that I've shared with Pete. Like, if you tell somebody how great a movie is, or how great a restaurant is, or how great something is, you subconsciously start rooting against it, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to do that either to myself about Drake May or to the people out there, because from everything I don't know him well. I've actually met his grandfather, know his brothers, but he's a good guy. I would hate to make people root against him. So I'm going to try to temper my quarterback crush a little bit over the course of the next year. It's for his own good. You know, right?
Yeah, I'm doing the same thing with Arch Manning, so I understand. Okay. I'm trying not to get too excited about Arch. You know, who knows if he's going to play this year? But I understand where you're at. You want to enjoy it quietly sometimes,
right? Yeah, that's what we'll do. So on the next podcast, Pete, the next time we have Matt on, now that we've suckered him in, we'll go, should Quinn Ewers be benched in favor of Arch Manning?
Oh yeah.
What did you think of the spring practice clips 8 that Texas released on their website? Did you think that 6-yard out he threw? Do you think he should be the starter?
Yeah, can he get the ball to Xavier Worthy down the field? These are the questions I'll be camping out watching over the summer. Yeah.
Matt, this was great fun. Thanks for being with us. Really appreciate you. Pete, great talking to you again. Make sure everybody in the Thamel household gets back to 100% health. There's a lot of news to be followed over the next few days. And thank you for listening. We're going to continue to do this throughout the offseason and also leading up to the draft. Thanks for listening to the College Game Day podcast. You can download it wherever it is you prefer to get your podcasts.